Welcome to a special edition of the Cosmosphere Podcast. In episode 18, we've got my chat with Rick Houston, author of Go Flight, The Unsung Heroes of Mission Control. I'm your host, John Molnix, and I'm a volunteer here at the Cosmosphere. You can catch me on this podcast and on my other show, The Space Shot. Rick was at the Cosmosphere earlier this week to give a presentation, and I caught up with him before his speech. He also hosts an excellent podcast called Go Flight, and we're linking to it in the show notes. Be sure to give it a listen.
Okay, status check, go, no go for LOI. Retro?
We're Go Flight all the way. From
green light. Fido?
We're Go Flight.
Guidance?
We're Go with no attitude.
Control? Telecom? GNC?
We're Go with the one reminder remaining flight on the jet selects.
You got that, Capcom?
Negative.
Tell him what it is, GNC.
BD roll?
Roger, he's got BD roll disabled. Would like to enable it, just a reminder sometime prior to the burn.
That's the auto RCS.
It's firm. Okay, you want to go green, GNC? Ecom, are you go?
Resurgent?
We go.
ONP, AFD, FAO.
Go.
Green light, network. Recovery, I guess you're go.
Right.
Okay, Capcom, give me a green light, and we'll go for LOI.
Roger.
Rick, welcome on to the Cosmosphere Podcast. It's great to have you here. You know, let's talk a little bit about the book that you co-authored with Milt Heflin. It's titled Go Flight, The Unsung Heroes of Mission Control. What made you want to write this story?
Well, that's a very, very easy question to answer. My friend Milt Heflin, who I met when I wrote my book, Will Stop, about the space shuttle program. Milt was an Apollo era flight director. And during Apollo, he was actually in landing and recovery. So he was actually on the recovery ships when those magnificent spacecraft came in for landings. And when I met Milt for the first time, I was in Houston to do some research on another book that I was doing at the time. And Milt had offered to take me on a tour of Johnson Space Center. And he took me to the neutral buoyancy laboratory.
Oh, wow.
The big pool, you know, where they do the EVA training. But they wouldn't let me suit up and go for a swim, you know, so it was just
that's a big shame.
You know, it was a big swimming pool. So then we went to the robotics laboratory. And I got to shake hands with the Robonaut prototype. And that was pretty cool.
No doubt.
But then he took me to the third floor Apollo era mission control room. And I am a history buff in general anyway. Mm-hmm. But when I stepped foot just inside the door, I was maybe 2 or 3 feet in, and I had this overwhelming sense of history wash over me, unlike any other that I'd ever experienced, with the exception of Gettysburg and Antietam and Dealey Plaza. But I walked into that room and I did not feel worthy to be standing there because I'm just a dumb writer. but when it dawned on me what had taken place there, I was literally overwhelmed with a sense of very, very powerful history. When Neil Armstrong said, you know, Houston Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed, he was talking to that room. When the crew of Apollo 13, you know, said, Houston, we've had a problem, they were talking to that room and they were looking for help from that room. And the last words that the crew of Challenger ever spoke back to Earth were spoken to that room. And in that moment, I knew that I wanted to do something to honor the people that had worked there.
It's an incredibly humbling. I was lucky enough to see the Moker consoles when they were being restored at Spaceworks, and that was the exact, you know, that was the feeling I got too, just being around those. It was, you know, and even now talking about it with you here, I'm getting chills just because there's so much history that was witnessed and that was made with, you know, at those consoles. So I can't blame you for wanting to write about them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And about 6 months later, I got an email from my series editor, Colin Burgess at the University of Nebraska Press. Mm-hmm. And he asked me if I had any book ideas. And I said, it's funny you should mention that. And that was the very, very, very easiest book pitch I ever had because it was such a no-brainer.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of the series that the University of Nebraska Press puts out is Go Flight and then Wheel Stop. There are two of, oh gosh, how many are in that series now?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I know it's at least 10 or 12. It would have to be.
Definitely. Well, and you know, Go Flight and Wheel Stop, they're two of the, you know, Go Flight was a huge resource for me when I was in school. So it being able to talk to you now is just an awesome experience too. So, you know, it's part of that process, you know, is getting up, coming up with that pitch. But it sounds like, you know, your relationship with Milt, it gave you kind of, you know, some inside, you know, an inside track as it were on maybe, you know, you had an idea of what you wanted to write about beforehand, or can you talk a little bit about that process?
Well, to be honest with you, when I wrote my book, Wheel Stop, about the space shuttle program, I was probably a little too intimidated by the technical aspects because I am not an engineer. I'm not a mathematician. I'm certainly not an astronaut. But when I dove into the mission control project, I really wanted to get a sense of what it was like to work in that room. And I had already established a very strong relationship, friendship with Milt. And so I don't know that I was hesitant to do it or nervous to do it, but I sent him an email and I told him what I had in mind. And I asked him if he would consider serving as a co-author. And he and I have laughed several times, many times, actually. I wrote the book. I think that he actually physically sat down himself. I think he wrote maybe two or three paragraphs. I wrote the rest of it. However, his fingerprints are all over that manuscript. When I had some kind of question about how procedure or how they would go about doing things or, you know, some of the language that they might use or how they might respond in mission control during certain situations, Milt had the answer. And he also provided a great sense of resource, you know, because when I needed to or wanted to interview somebody, if I didn't already know how to get in touch with him, he would dive in and he would get me what I needed, or he would make contact and put them in touch with me. But he was absolutely essential to this book. It would not have happened, certainly in the format that it's in now, the way that it did without Milt.
Well, you know, in the format, just the stories from basically Gemini up through, and you know, specifically what we're talking about today, more of, you know, Apollo 11, just the, you know, the insights that are in this book that you know, that there's an excerpt from a speech that Gene, or a little private speech that Gene Kranz gave the Moker, the mission control room guys right before landing. And that, you know, when I read that and I was just rereading parts of that chapter here before we were chatting today, that's still that type of history that you can get that insight from somebody that was around during this time is so beneficial. So I'm glad that Milt was able to put his fingerprints all over this project with you.
Well, you know, one of the things that I'm most proud of about this book is that it is the story of many people who work in that room. You know, we know the name Gene Kranz because of the movie Apollo 13, and because of the fact that he was the flight director on console when Apollo 11 landed. And his recognition is absolutely positively deserved. He is a king in that business. But there were also other people who worked in that room and who were absolutely essential to what went on in that room. And I am so proud of the fact that their stories are being told too, and that they are being recognized as people who once upon a time had absolutely extraordinary jobs.
Well, and that's, you know, that's the subtitle of the book is The Unsung Heroes of Yes. Mission Control.
Yeah.
And, you know, Gene, you know, the flight director, you know, those guys and gals, they're able to do their job because of the work of everybody else at all the other consoles in Mission Control. So being able to hear the unsung heroes, that hear their stories, is something that just, it sheds so much more light on, you know, one of the most important events in human history.
Well, you know, the thing that kind of sticks with me is, you know, Gene was one of the first four NASA flight directors, but Glenn Lunny was also. He was named at about the same time as Gene was, if not the same press release. And Glenn is absolutely one of the most intelligent, the most brilliant people I've ever met. His brain works so fast that, you know, you could probably throw him a few manuals and within a week or two, he could probably walk right into that control center today and be a flight director. He is that brilliant. And also Jerry Griffin. He was the only person during the Apollo era to lead, to serve as flight director for more than one lunar descent. Jerry was on console for three lunar descents.
Wow.
Nobody else did more than one. So, you know, it's nice for them to get recognized, but it's also nice, in my opinion, for people like Bob Carlton to be known, for people like Bill Moon to get some recognition. Certainly Jerry Bostick, John Aaron, because they were all absolutely essential to that magnificent program.
Well, and that's, you know, like each flight director had, like, there's the different teams and everything, and they all had their own, I guess, style, for lack of a better term. And that's something that, you know, going through and reading the book, and I listened to it on audiobook during a long road trip one time, too. So I've gone through it a couple times, and having our conversation now, it's making me remember little parts of the book, and I want to go back and read it again.
Yeah,
But that was one of the things that really stuck out at me is just the personalities of everybody and just their own little quirky, you know, how they would say things or how they would go about doing things in Mission Control. Is there something that, you know, that sticks out to you that's your favorite, you know, either kind of just a personality or just a fun anecdote from that time?
Well, John, you can't mention the phrase personality without mentioning Ed Findell. Ed has a personality that is absolutely as big as all outdoors, if not bigger. Ed is something else. I'm not sure how old he is. He's in his late 80s.
Okay.
But to this day, he still is involved in Habitat for Humanity construction projects.
Wow.
Yeah. So awesome. He takes part in that. at, you know, the young age of 86, 87, 88, somewhere in there.
Sprightly.
Yeah. But he called me the other day, and he said that he had been on a work site that day and had taken a tumble. And, you know, obviously, you know, that's a concern.
Yeah.
And so I asked him, I said, did you break anything? And he said, yeah, my head, because he had evidently leaned over on a sawhorse and somehow the sawhorse had given way or the board had given way
The
board wound up hitting him in the head.
Ow.
And I asked him, I said, was anything broken? He said, no, my head. And I kind of hesitated for a second. And he said, you want to say that was the best place to hit me, didn't you? Because I have such a hard head. And I said, well, I was thinking it. I wasn't going to say it.
Oh, my goodness. That's great.
But, you know, there are so many personalities that worked in that room. Bill Moon is just an absolutely phenomenal person. Mm-hmm. Bill is the son of Chinese immigrants. He grew up in rural Mississippi, the Mississippi Delta, in the late 1950s, Jim Crow South, at a time that was not kind to minorities, obviously.
Yeah.
But he said that he was never once subjected to any kind of racism. But he at the age of five, he began working in his family's grocery store. And I think that gave him a work ethic at a very young mm-hmm. age. He went to Mississippi State, and he was a founding member of a social fraternity at Mississippi State in the early 1960s, again, when minorities weren't exactly accepted. But he came through it unscathed, and he one day helped land people on the surface of the moon. And one of my, you know, there are so many stories. He said that one time he was at a function where Jim Lovell was, and he said that Jim Lovell came over to him and hugged him and told everybody around that that was the closest he would ever get to a moon.
Oh my gosh. That's, yeah. That is good.
Yeah. But when it comes to stories, I could go on and on and on.
I'll have to have you on again in the future so we can do that. Cause I know you've got a speech you're giving tonight at the Cosmosphere. So we want to be conscious of your time here. You know, one other thing I wanted to just ask you about and just talk about is when I was going, just rereading that chapter on Apollo 11, I remember seeing that one of the flight controllers drove, it was like a Ford Model A, like a 1929 Model A Mission Control when we were landing on the moon. And I really think that kind of sums up just the timeline of how absolutely, you know, staggering this achievement, you know, is in history and will go on to be, you know, remembered in history. You know, what does something like that mean to you, you know, when it's to you personally, when the moon is basically, you know, landing on the moon's three decades away from a 1929 Ford Model A?
Well, I could probably go you one better than that.
All right. Sounds good.
That was Dave Reed who drove the 1928 Model A, I believe it was. And he did that. But John Llewellyn once had his parking pass revoked for the Space Center. And so he responded by bringing his horse trailer, parking it across the street, and literally riding his horse.
Oh my gosh.
For, you know, but, you know, it's a good point that you make. The 1929 car, and certainly before that, the horse. These were all modes of transportation that not very long before Apollo 11 landed on the moon were the primary sources of transportation. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, a man-made object got put in space by the Russians, And then the space race started. And then President Kennedy stood before Congress and said that we were going to land a person on the moon by the end of the decade and bring him back safely. And the people who worked in that room, most of them, some of them were not even in college yet. Some of them, you know, were still in college when he made that announcement. But they didn't know that it couldn't be done. And so they responded by literally writing the book on flight control, on how to be a flight controller. And Ed Findell learned how to read a schematic by drawing with crayons and coloring the schematics in with crayons. And they literally had to do it from scratch. And that's one of the things that I respect so much about what they were able to accomplish.
There's so many things that we're pioneering about Apollo that, you know, it makes sense that they literally had to write the book on how to do things.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Rick, I can't think of a better way to end on, you know, that kind of just pondering. You know, everybody should ponder that for a few minutes here. but yeah, we're looking forward to having you on the podcast again in the future. And I wish I could be out there for your speech tonight, but I am sitting here in Colorado. I'll be out there tomorrow, so I'm just going to miss you, sadly.
Okay. All right.
Well, Rick, thank you very much again for coming on. It's been a pleasure having you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Cosmosphere Podcast. Make sure you share and subscribe to the show. If you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts. They help more people find out about the show. For the Cosmosphere, I'm John Molnix.